Good morning, River Church.
Hi, I'm Michelle Albertson. If you don't know me, I'm a member of the board here, and I'm pleased to be here this morning to help talk with an expert that we've invited to come here today and this weekend to educate us a little bit more on what churches need to know about building a safer environment. This is part of the River's commitment to learning more about abuse in general, and more importantly, how we as a church can become a safer place for people of all ages and all circumstances. I'll be talking with Maureen Garcia, if you want to join me. She is a lead safeguarding specialist with an organization called GRACE. They are committed to godly response to abuse in the Christian environment. So if you can help welcome Maureen. Hi, thank you for being with us here this weekend. A number of us were here yesterday to hear you speak, and I'm excited to hear what you'll share today.
Okay, thank you for inviting me. It's been wonderful being here.
Great. So to start out, could you tell us a little bit more about what a lead safeguarding specialist does and your role at GRACE and how you got involved?
Sure. So lead safeguarding specialist is basically, I'm on the team that does more proactive work with abuse. So I do trainings with churches. I help churches to create thorough and effective policies and then implement them. I do consultations when pastors or leaders find out that something happened in their church 20 years ago or last week or this last Sunday. We'll do consultations, me and my team. Like every week we'll get numerous ones. But basically we'll talk about whatever the situation is, and then we'll talk about what kind of concerns we have or what kind of options are available for the leaders to begin to think through and choose in order to care for their community, to care for the victims in their community, to assess safety, to hold people accountable that need to be held accountable. So that's what a safeguarding specialist does.
Great. And how did you get involved in this line of work?
Okay, so there's two answers to that question. One of them is the more practical one. A number of years ago, I was at a conference for abuse advocates, and I was on a panel about spiritual abuse. At the same time that I was there, my colleague now, Mike Sloan, was doing a presentation at that conference on domestic violence or interpersonal abuse. And, we met at that conference, and then we kept in touch for years. And at the time, my job was as an educator in a college. I taught research and writing skills to freshmen and graduate students. But at some point, Mike contacted me, because again, we kept in touch, and he said that they were looking for someone to do the safeguarding leading stuff, and he thought of me and would I apply, and so I applied and they hired me, and it is amazing, and I love working for GRACE, and it's very heavy work, but it's so worth it. The second part of that question goes back a little more. So when I was much younger, I was married to a man who identified as a Christian. And after a decade of being married to him, a child who was 12 came to me and sat at my kitchen table and with great difficulty told me that the man I was married to then had been sexually abusing her from the time she was 9 until she was 12, which is what she was then. And so that began a whole lot of things. One of them was I realized I didn't know anything about abuse. Like, I didn't know what to do. Like, what's the next thing you do when a child tells you this? And then basically just what do you do? So I did the best I could during that conversation. I reassured her and said, we're going to figure out what to do. And then I had all kinds of questions, like, what does this mean about the man I was married to? Is this a sickness that can be healed? Is it something like an addiction that can be managed? Is it just pure evil? And what does that mean for, our future? And ultimately, I came to the conclusion that I would never be able to trust him around children again, so you can't have a marriage in that case. But I did, after talking to the child, a friend of mine made an appointment for me with one of our pastors, and he did all the right things. He was supportive, he listened, he believed me and the child. He had known me since I was about 15, I was about 30 at this time, he basically told me, well, these are our legal obligations, and these are our choices for how we can go about, you know, meeting these legal obligations. And, you know, he talked me through, and him and the assistant pastor kind of, you know, supported me and came alongside me while we had to go through that whole process of supporting my then husband. And but that got me started, well, it got me started in a lot of therapy and a lot more prayer than I had been doing before. But what happened then was a year later, one of my daughters who has allowed me, she allows me to share her story. One of my daughters was abused by a family friend who was a really good friend of mine and a father figure to me and was the most influential person in my spiritual formation in my life. And when she disclosed, we found out that he was a serial child molester, child abuser. And so, you know, the process I went through the year before when I didn't know anything, now I knew a little bit more. So we went through that whole process of reporting and, you know, I actually talked to him and had him turn himself in. At the time, he must have been almost 80. Everybody looked at him and was like, oh, he looks like Papa Smurf. He can't be dangerous. This man was very, 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 very dangerous. So I started researching everything I could get from every perspective on what abuse is, how it functions in Christian environments, what our vulnerabilities are, how do we protect people, how do we create safe spaces, how do we shift our culture so that we can recognize abuse or even recognize grooming before abuse takes place. And then, so that's how I, you know, came to work for Grace.
Mm-hmm. Before I go on, can I just say thank you for sharing your story with us?
Oh, you're welcome.
As Christians, we don't all have your job.
No.
But
I wouldn't wish you did.
But I think we can all say that it's important to us to want to commit to creating a safer culture at our church. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is that a biblical, you know, thing for us to want to do?
Sure. Okay. So can you do the Exodus slide? Yeah. Okay. So it's important for Christians to understand the dynamics of abuse because all throughout the Bible, from the very beginning in Genesis, you have the story of Cain and Abel. And God comes and says to Cain, where's your brother Abel? And Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? And the rest of the Bible is basically the affirmation that God is saying, yes, you're your brother's keeper. You're your brother's keeper. You're the foreigner's keeper. You're the widow's keeper. You're the orphan's keeper. You're your neighbor's keeper. You know, we are each other's keepers. That's who we are. So from the very beginning of the Bible, all throughout it, there are these themes of oppression. And oppression is the word that we translate from the words they used back then. And that's the closest that we get to our modern understanding of abuse. Oppression means somebody in a position of power and trust who is exploiting the vulnerable and misusing that power and trust. And in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, the way you'll see that happen will be people are being enslaved, or they're being financially exploited, or they're being sexually assaulted. Oppression, like if you want to look for themes of abuse through the Bible, you look for where oppression comes up. And God says over and over and over again about, he just talks about his heart for people who have suffered, like widows and orphans and foreigners. And so what's fascinating is, like in the story of Exodus here, you know, God liberates the Hebrews from Egypt, and he does that and says, you know, I'm going to take you into the desert. I'm going to teach you how to worship me, right? But he doesn't just teach him how to worship him. He's teaching them how to be a people that represent him, that represent his heart and his priorities. And one of the priorities you see over and over again is you care for the vulnerable. You protect the vulnerable. You make justice for the vulnerable. And he says things like, you know, you shall not wrong a sojourner, which is a foreigner, or oppress him, for you are sojourners in the land of Egypt, and you shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them and they call out to me, I will surely hear their cry. And this happens over and over again. And basically the message is, you know, negatively, if we don't act towards the vulnerable in the way God has called us to, then God says, I will step in, and I will be the one who has compassion on them, and I will also be the one that avenges them. Either you protect them or you deal with me. But positively, and this is so fascinating, and you can see this throughout Scripture too, the reasons God gives for why they should do this is empathy and compassion. Because you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt and were enslaved, because you understand what it's like to be a victim, to be oppressed, to be abused, you are now going to take that knowledge and you're going to behave correctly with people who are vulnerable within your midst. And that's how people are going to know that you're my people. So it's just, it's a fantastic, God is compassionate and has empathy and love and concern and calls us to do that as well. So.
Wonderful. So how do we do it? What are some of the best protections that we could be doing to prevent abuse?
Okay. The Anna Salter slide, please. Okay, so Anna Salter is a researcher, and she is like an expert on predators. And now, the way we do things at Grace is everything goes through two lenses. The first one is our faith. That's foundational. The second one is evidence-based research. And what we find is that a lot of the modern research on abuse dynamics aligns and echoes pretty much exactly the types of things that Jesus, the incarnate God, said, and that God in the Old Testament said about abuse dynamics and abusers. So, but Anna Salter talks about churches are particularly vulnerable. Foundational to our theology is forgiveness, giving people second chances, and believing people at face value. And so people who are looking to be predatory exploit those qualities of ours. So it's kind of like when Jesus says the whole, you know, you need to be innocent as doves, which we are, but we also need to be wise as serpents, which we need to get better at. And being wise as serpents is what we need to do. Anna Salter says that the best protection is our knowledge of abuse. And that's what, you know, our ignorance is the thing that gives predators their edge. So the more educated our community is, and the more everyone takes ownership over creating a safer culture and a safer community, the safer that community is, and the more will deter abusers, because they won't feel welcome to abuse in a community where everyone is taking some kind of ownership and has some kind of basic knowledge and understanding of abuse dynamics and practical skills to intervene. So the safest community is an educated community.
So if you could educate us a little bit more then on what are important things that we should understand about abusers.
About abusers, okay, yeah. So give me a second.
Sure.
So a couple of things to understand about abusers is because the majority of abusers are known and loved and trusted by their victims, about 90%. So that means that if you're a victim or a survivor, that the abuser most likely groomed you, which means that we love and trust our abusers. And the knowledge that they've abused us or others doesn't stop that. You can't flip a switch and just stop loving and caring for someone. So the abusers that I've known, the two men that were very Christian, one of the older one who was a serial child molester, was very involved in church for years and years, used to take me to church, used to give me theology books when I was 14 years old, and then discussed them with me. You know, I love them. I still love them. I get angry once in a while, but I still love them. And then my own, I'm also a survivor of sexual abuse. So my own, you know, offender, I love him still. You know, I have to set really good boundaries, but I still love him. So that's one thing to remember, is that they create this bond. Now, not every victim's gonna love their offender, but just keep in mind that some of them do. But the thing to know is that when offenders offend, they've made a decision before the event to abuse has happened that they are justified in abusing that specific person that they've chosen. So what that means is it's not a fall into sin or a mistake or an error or giving into a momentary temptation of lust. That's not what's happening. They have planned and calculated and fantasized and thought about those actions before they ever do them. The person who pushes and beats their spouse has thought about that and has given themselves permission in their own mind to do that. And so offenders have these cognitive distortions that allow them to abuse the people that they choose to abuse. So what that means is if you're going to minister to someone who's an offender, the way you do it is not by showing them compassion or empathy. You can feel it, but you gotta keep it to yourself, because once they get their hooks in you with your empathy or compassion, then they know how to manipulate you, because they pretend to be the victim. But what you need to do is you need to hold them accountable. There needs to be accountability and consequences. That's the way you love an offender, accountability and consequences. And you see this throughout the Bible. You also see this throughout the research, and I can tell you from my own life experiences that this, again, this is how you love an offender. You don't love them by making them feel better. They need to feel bad about what they've done. So you save your empathy and compassion for their victims, for the families of their victims, for their own family if they happen to have a spouse and children, or parents. You save your empathy and compassion for those people. For the offender, accountability and consequences is how you love them.
So moving on to the survivors, what are godly responses that we can have to people who have been victims and identify as survivors of abuse?
Mm-hmm. Can you go to the slide with the Samaritan story? Yes, okay. So we have an example. We have a lot of examples in Scripture, actually. There's a lot of imagery about God binding up people's wounds, rescuing them, liberating them. So those are some examples, having compassion on them. But Jesus gives this story in Luke where somebody is asking him about the commandments, the greatest commandments, and Jesus reduces all of the Torah to two commandments, which is a very popular technique that rabbis used at that time and still do. And he basically says, the two most important commandments, love the Lord your God with all your mind, your strength, and your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. So then this fellow says, well, but who's my neighbor, right? And so the profound thing to reflect on here is that when Jesus tells a story about who are our neighbors, he tells a story about somebody who's been beaten and assaulted, and then the person that cares for that person. So we know that people pass by the man who's been beaten and assaulted on the road to Jericho, but the Samaritan, the person in that culture who you would least expect to help the Jewish person, because there's racial tensions and religious tensions between those two groups, the Samaritan stops and helps this person. And in the same imagery that we get from God in like Ezekiel 34, he binds up the victim's wounds and he takes care of them and he uses his own resources, takes them to an inn, tells the person to take care of them, right? So that's a really good example of how we should be, responding to people who've suffered and been abused. Can you go to the pink slide? Yeah. So some practical things to think about when you know that there are people who are survivors in your community or are victims still that are just coming out of their victimization is to remember what the impacts are of abuse on a person. So for example, abuse attacks a person's sense of safety. It does a job on your limbic system and your central nervous system. So you want to constantly be trying to figure out, how do I create the safest environment for somebody who survived abuse? And, sometimes that means you have to ask them, is there anything when we do our Bible studies that activates your anxiety or reminds you of the abuse? Or, sometimes it's just, just being present with someone when they're suffering or when they're anxious or when they're weeping, so that you can be someone who is calm and listens and helps them to regulate their body just by being present, right? Like Jesus says, weep with those who weep, right? The other thing to remember is that abuse attacks a person's dignity. We're all created in the image of God. We all have value and inherent worth. And abusers attack that dignity because in order to abuse someone, you need to justify in your mind why it's okay for you to harm someone who's created in the image of God. So there's a lot of self-delusion that abusers do because they need to justify violating somebody who, you know, is created in the image of God. And what that communicates to the victim is a lack of dignity, a lack of valuing, you know, a depersonalization. And so you want to find opportunities to make survivors feel that they're worthy, that they're valuable. And different people will have different skill sets or creative ways of doing that. But you're only limited by your imagination as a community, but also as individuals. You know, how can you communicate dignity? You know, what makes you feel worthy and valuable? And then do unto your neighbors you'd like to be done unto yourself, right? The other thing to remember is that abuse decimates a person's ability to make choices. One of the first things that God gives us in the Garden of Eden is the ability to choose. You can choose to not eat of this tree, or you can choose to eat of this tree, right? And then that's a theme that pops up over and over again throughout the Bible. Choose you this day who you will serve. God is very big on us using the agency that he's given us to, you know, do things. He wants us to be empowered to act and use our own agency. But when you've been abused by someone, especially if you're in a long relationship with someone who has been grooming you and who's in a position of power and trust over you, they slowly begin to take away any decisions that you make for yourself, what you wear, what you eat, where you go, who you interact with, how you pray to God. You know, they very slowly and subtly coercively control the person until they have no more ability to choose to make decisions, simple things like, you know, should I wash the dishes or vacuum the floor? That can paralyze, just that question can paralyze someone who's been victimized. They haven't exercised their will because it's been destroyed. So giving them opportunities to use their agency can be as easy as, you know, okay, so you called me and you said you wanna talk to me, you wanna pray. Well, where would you feel comfortable doing that? You wanna go to a coffee house, you wanna walk in a park, you wanna meet at the church? So you just, in little ways, give them choices to exercise that muscle so that their will can become strong enough that they can begin to make better and deliberate choices for themselves, okay? And the last thing would be trustworthiness. As a community, you don't want to expect or require victims to trust other Christians or the leadership. It's the leadership and the community's responsibility to prove that they're trustworthy and to act in trustworthy ways. And one way to do that is by being as transparent as possible. And over time, the victim will see this person is trustworthy. Not to take it personally if they're not trusting you. It has nothing to do with you. It has to do with what the abuser did to them. The other thing to think about is, so when I found out that the man that I was married to had been, you know, abusing a child, like, you know, when I was present, like I'm in the kitchen cooking something, he's in the living room abusing a child. Like, we're 20 feet away from each other. So my ability to trust other people was shot, right? My ability to trust my own perception was shot. How can I have lived with this person, loved this person, laughed with this person, and not have been able to see the degree of deception and manipulation and harm that he was capable of causing? So I couldn't trust my own perspective. Who do you trust? Who can't you trust? I don't know. I'm the worst person to tell you, right? And then on top of that, you know, there's, you know, when you go to church and at church you're learning that God has these promises for you. But how am I supposed to trust God now because this happened and, you know, God is God, but this happened. So how do I then begin to trust God? So I had to relearn trust from the ground up, and it took lots of prayer and therapy and more prayer and some arguing with God. And, you know, eventually, like Eddie was talking about, like all that stuff, eventually there was beauty made from those ashes. But in the midst of it, if someone had told me that, I would have been like, you're crazy. I'm going to be like this for the rest of my life. You know, I can't experience God. I can't trust myself. I can't trust anybody else. So you just want to be just sensitive to the fact that trust is a really big issue for most victims and survivors. Sure.
You talked yesterday about some things that are not helpful for us to do as survivors. Could you touch on that?
Yeah. Okay. So if someone comes to you and discloses or wants to talk to you about abuse that they suffered like 20 years ago or abuse that they're suffering now, there's a couple of things that you don't want to do. You don't want to question them and have them, you don't want to do anything that communicates that you doubt them. Are you sure? But what really happened? Well, maybe you were mistaken. Maybe you were there was a misunderstanding, you know? You don't want to do that. You don't want to communicate anything that shifts the blame to the victim, because the abusers already had them internalize that it's their fault, that they're complicit in their own abuse, that they're responsible for their own abuse. And our job as the community of God is to lessen that burden for them. They have been sinned against. They are not the ones that have sinned. So you have to be very careful. Now, you may have thoughts like, well, that was a stupid decision. Why did she text him first? Kind of a thing. But you don't communicate that question to the person. you can have the thought. We're human beings. So you can have the thoughts that are not helpful. Just don't communicate them. The helpful thoughts are, I'm so sorry that happened to you. Ask open-ended questions. Have a posture of belief. It's not our job as the church to decide guilt or innocence. It's our job as the church to be with somebody in the midst of their suffering. If somebody is telling you something that's painful for them, eventually there'll be other people who are skilled at investigating that can figure out the details, but that's not us. That's not what God calls us to do. This isn't a criminal court. This is a place where we're to support each other and love each other and bear each other's burdens. So you just want to have a posture of belief, and then, yeah, just be with them and allow them to have big, scary emotions. Don't express your own big, scary emotions. You want to remain calm. So sometimes someone, like if a child is disclosing to you that somebody harmed them horribly, you know, you might have some violent feelings in that moment, but you don't want to communicate that to the child, because to the child you need to communicate that you're a calm, rational, safe person that's going to help them navigate this. And if you just get enraged, that's communicating, uh-oh, I've caused a big problem. This person's mad at me. They're going to be mad at my abuser. I love my abuser. What's going to happen? My abuser might threaten me for telling this. It's a whole thing. So you just want to remain calm and posture of belief and ask open-ended questions and reassure them that you're going to do, what you need to do to stop the abuse if it's a child, and that you'll be alongside them, supporting them throughout the process.
It's really helpful. So if someone does tell us about abuse, or if we witness something or we have a strong suspicion, what do we do with that?
Okay. So if it's a child in the state of California, you're a mandated reporter, you have to report suspected or known abuse. And mandated reporters are like teachers, therapists, those kind of people. However, if you're not a mandated reporter, as Christians, grace suggests that we have a higher ethical and moral responsibility to report outside, because we know that reporting works. So since mandated reporting laws have been in effect, it has reduced the number of children's deaths by abuse by about 50%. So it's very important for us to report, because you could be saving lives. So when you report, there's in the county you're in, Santa Clara, right? Mm-hmm. Has a website. And you can't really see it here, but if you go to like the Santa Clara Social Work Government website, they'll have a page on reporting abuse for children, and they have a number you can call. If you're a mandated reporter, you call the number, you report, and then within 24 hours, you fill out an online form that's also on that website, and you submit it. If you're not a mandated reporter, you just call. If you're not sure if abuse happened, you can call anyway, and the people who, like CPS, Children Protective Services, are skilled at asking questions to help you process through the information you have. You also want to call law enforcement, because law enforcement and CPS are supposed to share their information, but life can be overwhelming and work can be overwhelming, so that's not always as seamless as it should be. And you want to remember, when you're reporting, you're not telling people, I've caught a predator. You're basically saying, I have information that may be useful to you about a person who may be a risk. And so then you give them the information.
Great. If it's something in the church, should we tell someone in the church as well?
Yeah. Yes. So if it's something happening in the church or related to something to do with the church, you report outside first if it's criminal behavior. And then you report internally to your leaders, or often at Grace we'll recommend having like a safeguarding committee or a safety team of people that are kind of more informed about abuse dynamics, and you let them know. And then, you know, because the leaders might need to make some decisions. They might need to assess risk. They might need to, you know, hold someone accountable for a bit. They might need to make difficult choices with very limited information. They might know stuff that they've been, you know, aware of for a while, but there was never anything that rose to the level where you can report it. So they might know something about that same person. So you go and you let your safeguarding team or your leaders know. So that's what you do. The other thing is, I say report outside first, but when I told you my story, I obviously went and talked to Pastor Roger, Pastor Carlos, before I reported to the police, because I didn't know what to do. And I didn't know if the activities that were disclosed were criminal. So I went and got pastoral support to come alongside me to help me report. And that's totally fine, but you want to report outside first, even with leadership or pastoral help, and then report inside your church.
Well, we're coming up on our time together, but before we do, I'm wondering if you have a scripture to share that really underscores kind of all of what you're hoping to educate us in.
Yeah. So the slide with Luke, yep, there we go. So I've been thinking a lot about the Good Samaritan story because my husband's a New Testament professor, and he was talking to me about some insights he had about it recently, and so we were having a discussion about it. And normally when I think about it, I think of it in the context of the work I do, right? Like the stuff I told you before, that there's this imagery of Jesus suggesting we bind up people's wounds and we take care of them, and you know, this person is our neighbor, and that's wonderful. But in relation to, I started to realize in this conversation with my husband, he brought up the end of the story, which I never think about, but now I've been reflecting on it for days. So basically the end of the story is the young man says to, you know, Jesus finishes the story and says to the young man, you know, which of the people who passed by on the road to Jericho were the assaulted man's neighbor? And the young man responds with, well, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. And so that I started thinking about, you know, this is a very direct, explicit command by Jesus to intervene in cases where somebody has been assaulted or abused. And so that's, there's tons of verses I could tell you and pull from, but this is the one that recently has been heavy on my heart, this idea that, you know, go and do likewise.
Thank you for coming today. If we could all give her appreciation and the worship team. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
While the worship team comes up, I just want to say thanks to you as River Friends. This is a serious topic, and I appreciate that you are here and you've opened up your hearts and your minds on this topic. It really is critical to fulfilling our call as being a church family, that we really do dedicate ourselves to being more educated in this area. So thank you for your time.